Now, for something completely different, here is your host, former New York City radio star, now relegated to third-tier podcasting, Brian Wilson.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and people of all sexes, including everyone attending the annual Agoraphobics Picnic, welcome to the Celebrate Prozac episode of The Two and Only, a weekly slide down the razor blade of life into the logic-free zones, polluted politics, and media mayhem. Filling in today for your regular host will be Brian Wilson, with our celebrity guest, the relentless investigative journalist for the New York Post, best-selling author, primary defendant in this season's Santa's Beard plagiarism suit, and progenitor of the new arrival, Last Rights, the Death of American Liberty. Let's have a sitting ovation for James Bovard. James, here
Brian,
you are.
Brian, thanks for your kind words. Prozac picnic. I knew I forgot to include something on my schedule today, but, it's never too late for Prozac.
I won't keep you too long. And let me just say right off the bat, I'm sorry to interrupt your days of mourning for the passing of Henry Kissinger. I thought about putting off today's discussion and give you a little bit more time to get over the trauma.
It's sad because I was just finally starting to get over Kissinger's passing, and then the news came today that Kevin McCarthy is resigning from Congress.
Right.
And so it was, I mean, it's such a double whammy for me.
I know. Like I say, I'll be merciful and short. So probably getting over to the picnic will probably be resuscitative in a number of different ways. But along with everything else, the good news is the scoring of the best publicity ever with the New York Post publishing the entire first chapter of Last Rights, Tyranny Comes to Main Street. I kind of sort of think I know how you did that, but I think it was a great move. I think it's superb, really great. The entire
thanks
chapter.
Very much. It was very kind of the New York Post editorial page to run a big chunk of the book, and it's always a challenge when you've got a new book coming out to make people aware of it, to put it on somehow, try to get it at least on the tiny corner of the radar screen.
Yeah.
So this is a big help. So I mean, there's just so much else going on. I mean, it's really hard for me to compete with Taylor Swift.
Well, yeah, and all the books she's written. But I was thinking back in the day, which wasn't so terribly long ago, in talk radio, if you had any sort of a reputation and ratings, publishers would send you copies of new releases as they came out. And when I was at WABC, prior to Lost Rights coming out in 94, I mean, I've given a whole bunch of them away, but I mean, there were, I think that Timothy Leary's book was one of the ones sent to me by the publisher, and we subsequently had him on. It was a fascinating conversation, but I don't know how much of that still goes on today, but that was something that happened on a regular basis. Now, I guess you got to fight for any sort of exposure publicity that you can possibly get. But first of all, for listeners for whom this is bulletin news, you would have been among the earliest of heads ups if they had a subscription to my Brian Wilson Writes at Substack column. Everyone there got the good word as soon as Jim raised the Gadsden flag here a few days ago. So there. But from a professional perspective, I'm just wondering, is it safe to assume along this same line that talk show hosts and their guest invitations are pouring in to your humble abode, or do I need to plant an encouraging foot in the creative butts of my former colleagues?
Well, I've always had great faith in your foot.
Ah, yes, certainly one of the more effective parts of my anatomy. I'll do that. I got that. There's a number of folks out there, I'm sure. Mark Davis down in Dallas and Raleigh James up in Chicago and folks like that. But if they haven't heard, and I'd be kind of surprised if they hadn't, but I'll certainly get that out. I do want to go through a couple of things, because now that everyone's had a chance to actually see and read the first chapter there, the Main Street chapter, we mentioned this last week. Each sentence, in my opinion, each sentence in every paragraph of chapter one is an indictment of government, whether it's all the way from perfidious presidents and politicians and policies and programs, and of course, all the pejoratives they so richly deserve. There's some recent headlines that I think underline the point. Now, the Kevin McCarthy thing, I think that was great. He'd taken his blow-dried hair and quitting Congress. He's not getting his way, so it's the highway. And all that involves in that story and what he's doing and what representation has come to mean in Congress. Do you see there's a lot of retirements going on? I mean, are these people leaving because it's time to start cashing in on those spiffy pensions they've got? Or are they getting altruistically fed up at what a cesspool that whole operation is?
You are the idealist for that last possibility. I think a lot of them are not leaving Congress to cash in on their pension. It's more to cash in as a lobbyist, because a huge percentage of former members of Congress become lobbyists, though they're often there's some misleading labels and bait and switch, so they don't have to formally declare to be a lobbyist, but that's what they're doing, lobby their former colleagues, and a lot of them are getting at least seven figures salary per year. So it's possible there are some people who would leave Congress because they're fed up, but you know it's slim and none, and Slim's just left town.
Yeah, right. Well, Kevin McCarthy heading out. I didn't know that Kleenex needed a lobbyist, but that might be a good place for him there with that. Whatever. Kind of embarrassing. I think he doesn't get his way, so he's going, well, that's it. I'm going to take my nameplate and go home. But there are other things. Just cruising through the different news headlines around. Peter Schiff wrote an article about U.S. debt crisis going parabolic. And your points about the spendthrift ways of Congress, and they're essentially flat out ignoring the bankrupt state that the country is in and what they're going to do about it. The one that really caught my eye, though, was one of our favorites, Chris Wray. He was testifying, well, I think it was yesterday, in response to a question from the dove of the Senate, Lindsey Graham, asked him to give an assessment of the terrorism, what do you call it, terrorism matrix, something like that, that he's seen at this point. And Ray testified he's seeing blinking lights, blinking red lights of terrorism like he's never seen before. Do you think, especially since October the 7th, so I'm wondering if you thought that that's mostly true or mostly a setup using the reliable fear porn that government always uses?
Well, it's very important not to have the FBI budget cut. There have been so many either wrong or misleading or false statements by FBI chiefs in the last 30 years, starting especially in 30 years ago, 1993. There was a budget ploy that Louis Freeh used, FBI chief Louis Freeh. He was trying to get the media all upset with the Clinton administration for not giving them a bigger budget at the FBI. And so he was out there complaining that the FBI was so strapped for money that it could not even afford to pay for ammo for FBI agents to go target practice. And of course, oh my God, that's so terrible. That just proves Clinton hates America. And it's, there's so many different baits and switches. At the same time, the FBI was expanding overseas a lot, making the DEA and other agencies very nervous. But it's hard to tell because the FBI does a very poor job of processing the information that it gets. There are some smart FBI agents out there. There's some FBI agents who are, trying to do the right thing. But my impression, if you look at the history of the FBI during the Trump administration and the late Obama presidency, you had a lot of rascals rising to the top.
Yes, the name James Comey comes to mind immediately. But, speaking of Judge Louis Freeh, during his days at the FBI, at that time, and this was right about the time that you and I first got together, this was 1993, I was living north of D.C. in just outside of Columbia, Maryland. Across the street, two very nice people, who I'll discreetly not name, she was one of Louis Freeh's three secretaries. He was in what he jovially called the wires and pliers division of the FBI. He set the miniature cameras and the miniature microphones and things along that order everywhere they wanted to have eyes and ears. And what's interesting about it in this particular case with respect to your story about Louis Freeh complaining about lack of ammo. And so Bill, of course, my neighbor had to qualify you know, as every month at the range, and he would bring back all of the surplus ammo that did not get fired that day at the range for me to give them to him, because he knew I was shooting a lot back then. I had my FFL back at that time. I had my M16 at the time, and shooting full auto eats up a lot of ammo, not 9mm, but 220. Anyway, but the point is that for, I wasn't aware of it at the time that Free was complaining about a lack of ammo. All he had to do was come over to my place. I had a bunch of stuff that had been left behind at least once a month during the qualifying day that my neighbor had to go out. So it was that's an interesting comparison between Louis Free playing about that. They couldn't practice that when he was built. Damn it. Here's my neighbor bringing back well, he's retired now, so it doesn't matter all that much. But that was a funny story. And of course, you can't talk about either Christopher Wray or Judge Louis or the budgets or anything else without giving a nod to an article you've got up on your website, jimbovard.com, about the dearly departed Janet Reno and all of her fun things, not the least of which, of course, was Waco and all the great writing work you've done on that.
Yeah, I had some fun with that. That was a book review for Reason Magazine.
Yeah.
There's a new biography out about a very fawning biography. And as I said in the review, I don't know why someone would write a 200-page love letter to a dead politician.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it really had to go to the owner of a red truck. I don't know. Maybe that was where it went. What good things could you possibly say about someone who had direct oversight of the slaughter of women and children and men? And so it's just unbelievable. One of the things that that I came across that I did also want to run up against before we ran out of time was that there have been several articles in the WAPO and the Atlantic and so on. Even Zero Hedge picked up on it about the green lighting assassination of the presidents, according to Gates, the Florida congressman, about these different outlets publishing articles warning what a second Trump term, that it would turn America into a dictatorship. And the interesting quote that I wanted to call to your attention, assuming you hadn't seen it, was written by Robert Kagan. He's married to Victoria Nuland, who was really big in shoving the Steele dossier. And his article, Trump dictatorship is increasingly inevitable. We should stop pretending. And he goes on to talk about, you know, Trump's going to be the Republican nominee. And what are we going to do about it? If we thought there was a 50%, this is a marvelous thing. He says, if there was a 50% chance of an asteroid crashing into North America a year from now, would we be content to hope that it wouldn't? Or would we be taking every conceivable measure to try and stop it, including many things that might not work, but that given the magnitude of the crisis must be tried, quote unquote. The gaslighting of assassination comes into play at that particular point. And I just wonder if first of all, if whether you'd seen it or not. I mean, it's in the air. It's being bandied about. The meatball from Maryland was on MSNBC and pretty much chattering the same thing. I was just wondering if you had any early reaction to the way this dialogue is going.
Well, it's funny that a number of the folks who are trying to maximize the hysteria about Trump being a dictator don't have any concerns about arbitrary power if it's being used by Biden or if it was used by Obama or Bill Clinton. It's a very selective fear of dictatorship. I can understand why folks would be apprehensive about Trump because some of the things he said have been appalling. But on the other hand, this whole notion that President Biden should have veto power over who's permitted to challenge him next year, that's a death of democracy as well. So, you know, the entire political system is in a bad way at this point. And it's a hell of a thing that it looks like voters next year might have to choose between Biden and Trump. It's like, where the hell did this nation go wrong?
Well, yeah, there is that question, although I think there's an awful lot of people on the Trump side that are looking at it from the standpoint of, you know, that they want their at-bats, you know, that they their guy and their beliefs and their principles and their ideals have been beaten up, batted down, investigated, yep, and punished, you know, for all these years. You know, they endured Obama. They got Trump's all little saw a little light at the end of the tunnel, then all the scurrilous activities about the election, and we get this guy and all of the Merrick Garland ignorance and blindsiding and so on. I really think that's where a lot of the frustration and anger is coming from. They sit there and say, okay, we'll go back to those good old American ideals and become the shining city on the hill. What if we get our turn at bats, go out there and beat the crap out of these people? And I think that's why with some of the things that Trump is saying, while it's driving the left up the wall, everybody with the red hats is saying, yeah, baby, oh boy, boy, howdy. One final thing, Greg Gutfeld over at Fox, once upon a time, a few weeks ago, was talking about this line of talk and how it was kind of a conditioning process aimed at getting the average American, you know, the Joe Sixpack family of average Americans to accept the concept that this kind of violence, this kind of, you know, something like an assassination was really the best thing for the country. His point was that if you go around consistently calling somebody Hitler reincarnate, what could that do to motivate a conscientious person but to kill him? I mean, that was the ultimate goal of the World War, got to get Hitler. And as whacked out as too many people are today, who would doubt that possibility, considering the diligence and direction of law enforcement under the impeccable AG Merrick Garland? It wouldn't be difficult to imagine the leniency that would be afforded somebody acting it out. And I think that's where the real danger in all this is these types of things getting into common parlance on, even on something like MSNBC, which is not common, nor is it parlance, but nevertheless, somebody's watching it. CNN picks up on it here and there and so on. So it's, I'm just kind of concerned that, I'm just now remembering, it didn't get a lot of play, but Christopher Wray said just a few days ago, that there was at least one credible threat on the life of Trump.
Yep. Well, this is not surprising with the way the rhetoric has been cranked up. I mean, Trump did a lot of cranking up the rhetoric from 2015 onwards as well. But the latest rhetoric is probably harsher than what Trump was pushing. So yeah. I don't know. It's unsavory. 100 years ago, Henry Adams said, politics has always been the systematic organization of hatreds. And that's a lot of what we're seeing right now. It's unsavory. And sometimes I almost lose faith in the system.
Yeah, I know you're teetering on the edge, and I don't want to do anything that's going to, you know, create any sort of a zephyr that might push you over. So I'll, unless it'll get you to the picnic, you know, a few minutes early.
Never too late for Prozac, like I said.
That is true. Well, regretfully, the time has come, the walrus said, to get your butts out of here. Once again, the two and only have run out of road, and I've got to bring down the holiday-decorated Bovard curtain of mercy. But the good news is you can finish all your Christmas shopping in one place. Punch up jimbovard.com for a link to the Amazon order page and get yourself your last rites. That's the book, not your last. Well, you get the point. For the dynamic duo of A Christmas Gift, I was thinking you could get Lost Rites 1994 and Last Rites just out and be a strong witness to Jim's prescience on current events then and now. Of course, for the grand slam of Christmas Tingle, you can get Jim's Lost Rites and Last Rites and then add in my 50 stories and watercolor memories. And there's more than enough good time reading material to help you avoid family and in-laws for the entire holiday weekend. Assuming we avoid any mushroom clouds, we'll be back with another barely legal episode of The Two and Only, same time next week, with more scathing analysis, ribald commentary, and soporific observations on swamp creatures and our crumbling empire. For James Bovard, I'm Brian Wilson, subsidizing the adult section of the local apothecary. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us.